Hey, good day, everybody. Welcome to another great episode. They're all great, so I don't know why I would say that, but another great episode of the OIG Roundtable. Today, it's really the OIG Triangle. Wade McFall is on much deserved PTO with his family. It was his birthday, so he's off. So I am joined by Jason Eisengrein, retired executive from HHS-OIG and the retired UPIC West director in a t-shirt. I like that. I'm also wearing a t-shirt. And Matt Kachansky, Jason's counterpart, also retired executive from HHS-OIG and the retired Northeast UPIC. So we don't have to, if Wade was wearing a shirt with a collar, he'd throw it all off. So it's good. It's good that we've got the consistency. Jason, I did put in a memo, hopefully to get you out of the basement. Away from the lockers. We're working on hopefully getting that approved by senior management and getting you up to the surface. You deserve it after 45 years. So we got a great bunch of stuff to talk about today. The biggest thing, going back to discussions involving SIU operations and the like, we want to talk about medical record reviews and the importance of medical record reviews and how medical record reviews are at the clinical level, they're at the documentation level, and talk about that integration of medical record reviews within an SIU, writing them up and the like. So, you know, Jason, I'm gonna start with you in a minute because I know you're currently working on a very large process improvement project for one of our medium-sized SIU clients. And they, you know, they did not have a dedicated medical record review team or even dedicated medical record review resources until just recently. We brought somebody in to be their full-time medical record review person. It's a nurse auditor. And, you know, I think, you know, for me, I didn't fully appreciate at the OIG the value and importance of having medical record review staff on hand. I mean, we would get these referrals from the UPICs. We would get referrals from larger payers who had those teams. And it was a little bit like in the ether. You know, we have this review, it's been completed. If there's a statistical sample or a probe sample, there are some error rates, we would see that and then kind of, you know, work the investigation. It wasn't really until I got here and we started to, you know, and I started to integrate more of that into our workflows, you know, to kind of see that. But you know, I think, Jay, I want to start with you because one of the important pieces of the medical record review process is the consistency in the write-ups and making sure that there is a consistency in that. And we talk about that consistency across all lines when we're talking about SIUs. You know, Matt and I in our three-day on-sites that we've been doing, we talk a lot about consistency and documentation. We talk about it here on our podcasts about the consistency lends credibility. It adds to that professionalism. What are you seeing and what sort of suggestions and what things are you working on as part of the process improvement areas that you're working on with respect to the documentation and those write-ups?
Thank you, Eric. First, I would say that this is very much part and parcel to investigative planning. And we've covered that topic on a number of podcasts. So, you know, when you think about investigative planning, and especially in the context of what we already reported on, it also has to do with the ancillary and related resources that are needed to come to a conclusion of the investigation. And very much a part of that is the ability to have a medical review assessment. Now, okay, if the investigation is specific to technical denials like dates missing, signatures missing, things like that, yeah, whether or not you need someone who has that clinical expertise, you know, would be particular to the particular issue. But it was amazing to me that a lot of SIUs do not have that dedicated resource of being able to obtain medical records and then evaluate how they affect the process of the investigation. And part of that, again, being the investigative planning, what are you trying to prove? Because it's not really just about utilization review. Utilization review is an essential component of a good medical review in the investigative process. But it really is that as the investigation proceeds, you need to know, are you trying to prove intent? And is there something within that that record that helps establish that intent? And the other thing is that, I guess anecdotally, I'll just say, I was on a mission to improve the timeliness of medical review in another contract that I oversaw for several years. And when I started looking at it, one medical review write-up, as they've come to be known, it was 127 pages long. And, you know, it was just, it was all good information. It was accurate. I couldn't find anything wrong with it. But what did it do to bring that investigation to, you're either proving, or as we always say, we're proving or refuting the allegation? Where is that in that 127 pages? So in using that anecdote, I'd just say that things that came out of that review of mine was that we definitely needed to have the nurse reviewer, the claims analyst, you know, they go by a lot of different names. So they need to be part of the investigative planning process. At the point that you realize you need to engage medical review as part of that investigation, you need to bring the investigator and the medical review professional into alignment so that they're working together to get to the point of proving or refuting that allegation. And then the other thing is that there should be an executive summary, a template, a section that identifies what, you know, the allegation is, and key bullet points that are referenced within the technical material, so that a non-clinical person will be able to take that information and cross-reference it to the particular clinical pieces that establish that investigative finding. I'll pause there because this is, you know, there are a lot of other elements, and I think we're going to get into quality and whatnot, but I'll pause there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing that you know, the 127 page write-up, you know, if I got that as an investigator, my days at the OIG here at Advise, you just, you know, you open up that document and you look and you see it's 127 pages. You're reading the first page, you're reading probably the last two pages, right? Like, you just want to get to the heart of the matter. Like, what's the level of granularity may be important, but it certainly doesn't need to be 127 pages, right? I mean, the take home in these write-ups need to be this high-level summary. How many claims did you review? How many were supported? How many were unsupported? What's the error rate? What's the error? And error rate, you know, one of the requirements under the PIM is net payments, right? Net overpayments. The requirement under Chapter 8 of the PIM is that, which is the Program Integrity Manual, is that when you are assessing an overpayment or identifying an overpayment, it is the net overpayment, which is overpayment amounts minus underpayment amounts, or opportunities where there was an underpayment. So, you know, it's important that you, that understanding that when you see an error rate could be in your benefit, it could be to your detriment, and that you need to be able to break that out and see it. So, you know, these write-ups need to have kind of that templating, which you talk about is probably one of the most important pieces of the puzzle. It's not to say that the 127 pages isn't important. It certainly may be important for the purposes of litigation strategy and understanding kind of that granular level, but certainly high-level findings are what an investigator needs to get to that. So, go ahead, Jay.
One other thing that I think is really important at this section is to also realize what are the market requirements. If your end user, let's say it's a Medicaid managed care organization, and in that particular state there's a requirement to reprice the claim that you're looking at, you need to know that from that get-go, because to go back and re-review it from a repricing standpoint, that will totally kill your time frame and your resource.
Yeah, that's a super important point. I know that with a lot of our plans and a lot of the work that we do, we don't do a lot of the repricing because the contracts may be slightly different, particularly in the commercial space, and the plans have all of that pricing, which we don't have. what we do a lot with our Medicare related audit work is we do the repricing because the fee schedules are published. They're out there and there's no, you know, it's the transparency is inherent, but it's certainly right. Something that you have to think about as far as that. Now, what we're not suggesting is that you're adding in columns on a spreadsheet, on a billing history. You're not changing the data. If we find that if the claim shouldn't have been paid, then it's a zero, then it's a denial. It's not that much of an issue. But if, for example, you have an E&M, if it was billed out as a level 5, but it should be a level 3, there's a repricing. Sometimes you get an instance, maybe a modifier gave you the ability to bill something bilaterally, but the documentation only supports unilateral, right? So you've got a repricing there. There may be an instance where for some of the work that I do with law firms and the proactive stuff is we're finding potentially opportunities where something could have been billed that wasn't billed. And we're doing, we're alerting the client to that for the purposes of that. But Matt, I want to go to you. And then Jason, I'm going to go back to you for something that you talked about a little bit. But, you know, you started the discussion. And I want to turn it over to Matt, which is really the integration of the different functions that are out there and those subject matter experts that are needed within the pod, right? You can't just have people in their own sort of micro environment to do this. And one of the things that we've seen is on some of these smaller plans is relying upon the clinical subject matter expertise of someone in the medical director's seat to do a fraud, waste, abuse review, which doesn't necessarily work because they don't have the same eye for things. And so that integration becomes super important.
Absolutely. You know, in the traditional investigative planning, you know, you get data, you know, whether it's a data model that you're creating leads from, or it's data related to a specific complaint, it's looked at by the investigator. They create an investigative plan. They follow that plan and then hand it off to the medical reviewer to do the medical review of the records that they've obtained during the course of the investigation, comparing that to the policies and the regulations, and they come up with a determination. So it's this consecutive siloed approach, the handoff from one to another. What we tried to do with the UPIC, to different degrees of success, was to integrate that entire process. Whether it was a model coming that our data team was developing or a complaint that came in, the investigators, the nurses, and the data analysts all got together and provided, you know, the insights and the information that was needed to decide, you know, is this data model going to work? Does it clinically make sense? And if so, what are the policies? Let's research those policies and come up with an investigative plan based on those things to include the nurses who, you know, we were using RNCPCs and we try to get a wide spectrum of specialties. So whatever specialty we might've been investigating, they had the expertise in that and experience in that area to help us. And they would go out, do interviews with the investigators, go on site with the investigators, and in otherwise learn what that investigation was all about. And then they would also inform the data analysts on this data is important, this isn't, let's create the model differently because this is what makes sense clinically in the real world. Let's look for these things. They would also provide that insight to the investigators. When we're on site, we need to look for this. We need to find this in the medical record. These are the types of medical records and the sections of the medical records we need to obtain to make sure that these services are being rendered. You know, if there's a certain test going on, do they have the equipment? Let's check the calibration. We'll do this together. So it's all along the path. The clinical insight was informing the investigative process.
Yeah, and I then mean, when that, it came. That's really an important point, right? Like it's that integration. Investigators need to know the right questions to ask. Right. And oftentimes you glean those things from the conversations you have with your clinical and your coding staff.
Absolutely. And in many times they're right along with them asking those questions. If we were interviewing a provider, sometimes we did a large project involving home health. We were out for several weeks and in areas around Philadelphia. And we brought nurses and investigators on site, both to the provider's offices and to the members, to the recipients, you know, and the nurses were doing clinical analysis of the patients. Are they homebound or not? And we were getting a clinical analysis at that point. Now, right. At the end, and you talked about documentation a little bit, Jason, that report, the way we were doing it is, you know, the first part of the report was written by the investigator. Here are the allegations. Here's the information we've gathered. And then the medical reviewer, who has already been involved in the investigation, would then add on to that and say, based on the medical review, here's what we found in line with those allegations, whether they were refuted or supported or not. So it all kind of followed that template. And it worked very, very well for us.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, you know, what we're really talking about is there's two pieces of this puzzle that I see, which is it's how do you get the records, right? So that's your statistical sampling or your probe sampling. So we're talking about Chapter 8 of the Program Integrity Manual. And then the medical record review is in Chapter, I think it's Chapter 3 of the Program Integrity Manual. And the part that gets, I think, a little confusing is there are a lot of references in, we'll call it the PIM, right? The Medicare Program Integrity Manual. The Medicaid Program Integrity Manual is very similar. The chapters are all similar. But I think, you know, where you get some of this divergence is in Chapter 3, there are a number of references to what they call medical reviews involving medical necessity. And I think that there is this discernible difference. There's clinical medical necessity, and then there's the documentation medical necessity. And the PIM doesn't really clarify which is which. You know, obviously, the determination of whether a patient needs something or doesn't need something may be a clinical indication for which someone who is not a clinician shouldn't be answering. But, you know, the example I always give is you go to the doctor for a sore throat, and the doctor does an EKG on you. And the EKG is well documented, right? They've built the CPT code. They've put down whatever they're putting down. It's a well documented claim from the medical record perspective. There's an interpretation. There's a report. From a documentation perspective, an auditor might say, good to go, right? Because the documentation meets the requirements under the policy. But an auditor, a clinical auditor, like an RN-CPC, is going to say, no way. There's a divergence. The medical necessity to establish the reasonableness for that item, service, or procedure isn't there. So from an investigative perspective, you're right. It's super important for that integration. I know on our end here at Advise, whenever we're doing a project with a law firm or any of our work with DOJ or anything along those lines, I 99.9% of the time, I bring the auditor or the clinical auditor on the call. And one of the early conversations that we have with our clients is, what is the goal of this review? What are you trying to do? Are you trying to identify the medical necessity, or are you just trying to identify whether or not this was properly documented or not, right? If a patient has cancer and they're getting chemotherapy, I don't think there's a question about whether or not they have cancer or not. It's is that service that they're getting collaterally, right? So that integration becomes, you know, super important. We use here at Advise a mix. We have some people that are CPC, CPMAs, certified professional coders, certified professional medical auditors, and then we use clinical staff as well, RN-CPCs, right? So they're taking it kind of to that next piece. But that integration has to exist. You've got to have the ability to have your clinical people be there. I wish when I was at the OIG, I wish that we had this greater integration, right? We've been really working with a lot of our SIU clients to help to develop that. A ton of our staff augmentation is doing that, is bringing our clinical staff to the SIUs. You know, some of the OIG, VA OIG, for example, has a full-time clinical auditor in-house for the VA OIG healthcare work, right? They've got that. I think HHS OIG, I think, unfortunately, relies upon its relationships with the UPICs. And as you guys both know, the problem with that is it's not an open wallet, right? The UPICs don't get to just say, sure, no problem on those requests for assistance, which creates the delays and all of that. And we've been working very hard to help to integrate with some things at HHS OIG to help to maybe, you know, stave off some of that time that's out there. But it's an important piece of the puzzle. You cannot have people who don't have the fraud, waste, abuse compliance eye doing these reviews, because they may just not have that same mentality. So Jason, I want to go back to you, because obviously in creating that consistency in the write-ups is the ability to QA the work product to make sure that it's going out properly. And then what you like to talk about, which is the IRR, right? The inter-rater reliability. So if you just talk about, kind of give you the last word on this, because you can have all of these processes in place, but at the end of the day, if you're putting out a crappy work product, then none of it matters, right? You know, I always say, and I was just at the American Health Law Association in Baltimore at a conference last week, and I sat in on a panel about statistical sampling and reviews and audits. And one of the first things I said was, the very first thing you do when you get a statistical sample of records and you're looking to fight it is you challenge the methodology and the science behind it. You know, one of the biggest thing in statistics, which makes statistics a science, is the ability to replicate the results, right? In science, they'll say, you know that your scientific methodology is sound when you can replicate your examination and get the same results. And that's an important piece in statistics. But I always say to people, when you get a statistical sampling of records, and you're required, by the way, under Chapter 8 of the PIM, if you're getting an audit from a UPIC or a MAC, there's a requirement for the auditing organization. They have to turn over all of the work papers. It's part of the program integrity manual. So you get the ability on the provider side or what have you to interrogate the data and identify whether or not the data was produced in a scientifically sound way. And then if you can't attack that, then the next thing you do is you attack the audit itself. But part of being able to have a quality audit that stands on its own is good QA and this IRR.
So to have a good QA process so that, and to use your technical term, so you don't end up with a crappy work product, you have to know what are the parameters that are used to establish whether something was crappy or defective in some way. So Matt had some really excellent points in there, and he talked about the medical director and the medical director's piece of the puzzle. Well, you need to know in your market what type of medical director is needed. So many times, and in many cases, it's a medical director who is a licensed practicing physician. And then in other markets, it's going to be actively practicing in the geographic area of the claim. Sometimes it's actively practicing and, you know, specifically in the same city. And, you know, to get Dr. Sally that's willing to comment about Dr. Charlie's work down the street, that all becomes very hard to do. So these are just things that you need to realize when you're going into it. But the other thing is that, you know, you need to delineate what your QA process is. So if it's that the clinical reviewer, the clinical assessor is preparing a write-up, and every single one of those write-ups is going to be reviewed by whom? And is it just they're going to be the medical director, or is there a piece in between? And so all this QA is very expensive, and there is a modality of inter-rater reliability. And basically, it's a way of collecting data about a particular clinical person's performance along the way. And at some point you can look and see that, well, wait a minute, clinical reviewer A is right like 93% of the time. And it allows you then to scale the amount of QA that goes into the various people that are doing it. So someone else who might be newer or maybe just not particularly in tune with a particular service, there might be any number of attributes that drive that and change the inter-rater reliability, so that reliability piece. But being able to scale that quality and still end up with not a crappy product is really a good use of resource conservation.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the biggest piece in that is on the QA side is the auditor looking at the right policy for what they should be? Are they looking at the most recent policy and not one that's been sunsetted or updated, you know, that's aged, right? That's number one. And particularly in our space where we're doing a lot of work across Medicaid lines of business, are we looking at the Medicaid policies for the right state if they have a policy? You know, one of the things that I ask all the time is particularly on the work that we're doing with our MCO on the provider side, the very first thing I do is I say, what is the policy that you guys are supposed to be following? Does your network contract with the Medicaid plan or the MAO or whoever it is, does it delineate that you're going to be following CMS's guidance, NCDs and LCDs, for example? So, you know, that's at least the very beginning. I think, you know, the take home for me, and both of you kind of touched upon it, is you've got to have the right people doing the job. You can't bring a knife to a gunfight. And the example that I'll give is we worked here on a project involving a provider that had been indicted on $1 million or so in the New York area. And it was an OIG case out of our old office, Jason. And they got it wrong. I mean, that's just, they got it wrong. There was an audit that was done. It was a psychotherapy case. And the nurse auditor that did the review did not have the requisite knowledge and experience in psychotherapy reviews and ascribed a 66% error rate from a statistically valid random sample. So we looked at the sampling. We had our statistician look at the sampling. It was replicatable. It was accurate. It was appropriate. So we then went and looked at the review itself, and we didn't rely upon a nurse auditor who wasn't conversant in psychotherapy. And we had the records reviewed by a forensic psychologist who does this every day, all day. We brought a howitzer to this. And at the end of the day, our clinical forensic psychology auditor, whatever you want to call them, had a zero error rate. And we found a lot of flaws in that review, not just in the denials, but what really turned out to be just poor quality at the end of the day. And what wound up happening was a $1 million indictment turned into a $125,000 plea. There was fraud, right? There's no question. And there was an acknowledgement that there was fraud, but it wasn't $1 million. And the error rate that was in that statistical sample was wrong. And we knew it was wrong. So it's you've got to have the expertise. Apples to apples are an important piece of the puzzle. And that goes to what both of you have been talking about. It's part of that quality and that and making sure that those write-ups have a level of professionalism and consistency. And Matt, it hits right into the integration that you can't have people entirely siloed when they do this. You've got to have auditors that are conversant in fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance and understand the implications. You know, we would get referrals at the OIG. We'd get these referrals that were based upon a technical violation of a signature missing. And I say, well, that's someone who wasn't really, because, you know, the two things that I think you can always overcome, illegible notes and lack of signature. CMS actually has guidance on doing attestations and doing transcripts for illegible. You should never get a denial from a payer because of illegible notes or lack of a signature. That to me is the silliest thing in the world to get a denial, because you'll win on an appeal, right? Bringing that integration of your team in can help to get rid of those, you know, kind of false positives, right? Because to make a referral and go through all the machinations for something that's ultimately going to result in a reversal of a claim for pay, it just seems like we can do a better job of that. And I think that's, you know, at least what we try to do with our clients. Matt, I want to give you the very last word on this.
Okay, just a couple of points on the QA. One of the things we did to make sure that there was the right policies and things, when a nurse was assigned the matter to look at, they would go through about five claims, and then our QA person would look to see the results of those five claims. Yeah, you're on the right track. These are the right policies. Go forth. And then there was another QA at the end. So kind of, you know, it was an ongoing process, a two-step process. On the integration, one tip, you know, if nurses and investigators, they're going out and doing interviews of members or beneficiaries, you know, whether they're part of the statistical sample or not, get those records that you've done the interviews on and have those reviewed, because even if it's not part of the sample, you put it aside as possible evidence of intent. You know, were those, you know, the beneficiary said, never was there, here's my calendar, I was out of town, and all of a sudden there's medical records to support the claim, you know, you got a bigger problem than just, you know, overbilling or medical necessity. You got services not rendered and an intent to defraud the system through submission of false records.
Yeah, important point. Super important point. That really is a little bit more of the overall investigative planning and investigative process. But, you know, the point being, if you get a statistically valid sample of records and people that you've interviewed are not captured in that sample, ask for those records nonetheless. You've got an interview that's been done with someone. Why not have the records to either refute, confirm, or whatever it may be, an allegation? It's a great point, and that really should be part of that. And that's where your medical record review, clinical, and auditing team are going to help you with shaping those discussions. So it really is an integrated approach. SIU should not be operating in silos. They really should be working in a much more back and forth conversational area. I know, Jason, you're working super hard with our one client right now to work on those integrations. And, you know, we're doing a lot of training with that same client on a monthly basis. Now we're doing training sessions with them to work to get them out of that siloed mentality. So,
and just, if I can, just don't forget the data piece. It's a triune situation, right? So it's not just the clinical, it's not just the investigator, but data. And you've mentioned that about the sample size and how important that is. So, and that can be an evolving process when you talk about confidence levels and things like that. It can change.
Figuring out the universe is going to be based on the allegation and what you're trying to prove. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it really is one of these things where there almost should be versions of the MCC, the major case coordination, with those SIU teams to talk about what do we need to go forward on this? What do we have? What do we need? And what do we want? Because those aren't always going to be the same. So as always, it's been great. I'm glad to see it. We at least got the shirt issue resolved for this week. Next week, we'll see what happens.
Looks like he's going to be an extra on the remake of Scrubs or something. I'm not sure.
Jason is always, he's always wanted to be a scrub tech. So we've got some exciting news. We're going to be rolling out an RN CPC bootcamp. This will only be available to currently licensed and working currently licensed RNs. If you're on a sabbatical, as long as your license is good. It's geared directly to you RNs as professionals looking to move to the next step, next phase, next whatever in your career. It's going to be about a 3-month course. It's going to be 2 nights a week. It's going to be live. A lot of the courses are not live. They're all 100% previously recorded or self-guided. So there's going to be a lot of interaction. Please keep your eyes out for that. We're doing this at a very aggressive price point. We really want to be able to get this community to move on into other areas where they may think there's going to be. So we're going to have some information out in probably the next week about it. It's going to be starting in January. We think this is going to be a course that's going to have a lot of interest. We're gearing it directly to the nursing community. And so there are going to be some areas that are not going to be covered because your clinical experience is something that's very valuable, and we don't want to rehash things that you already know. We want to spend the time on the things that you need to do. So keep your eyes out for that. Again, to get our newsletter, which all of this will be in the newsletter, send us an email at hello, H-E-L-L-O, at sign, advise, A-D-V-I-Z-E, health.com. If you are going to be at the NHCAA in the first week of November, please stop and see us at our booth in the vendor area. I'll also be speaking with Tim Dineen, the SIU director of Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield. We're going to be talking about SIU improvement and management related things. So we've got a lot of great things coming up. As always, catch our newsletter every week, catch our podcasts. We've got our LinkedIn Live coming up in another week or so. Myself and Julie Janeway, we're going to talk about compliance as a culture. That's another one we're super excited about. So we appreciate all of you tuning in, and we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable.
Thank you all.